Hey everyone, Dr. Jason Old here, surfer, historian, world traveler, and your host of the Surfing Historian Podcast. This season, we'll be diving deeper into the nuanced world of surfing and examining the historical, cultural, philosophical, and even scientific elements of the sport we're all stoked on. So let's paddle out together and ride through the world of academia. This episode is sponsored by Santa Barbara Surf Company, an ethically crafted surf brand that celebrates a diverse community of surfers, musicians, travelers, and artists. Check them out at sbsurfco.com and use promo code STAYSTOKED for a discount on their awesome merch. Joining me today from Ventura County, California is environmental science and resource management professor, Dr. Dan Reinemann. Dan is a fifth generation Californian from San Diego who confessingly has a love affair with the coast. His current obsession, the Channel Islands, which conveniently for him is where he spends most of his time, being that he works at California State University, Channel Islands. He's lived in Southern California, Northern California, Hawaii, DC, and even on various small islands and boats. He's convinced that science is the best career choice ever, for him at least. His goal is to ensure that healthy waves and coasts are accessible to his kids and others' kids so that they can enjoy them in much of the same ways that he's been able to enjoy them. Dan's a scholar of coastal resource management, or as he calls it, coastography. For today's episode, we'll be chatting about an article he co-wrote with Nick Saudrapur titled "The Impacts of Climate Change on Surfing Resources." I'm super stoked to have you on to share all this incredible information with our listeners. But before we get started, I want to personally thank you, Dan, as well as our listeners, for being part of this episode of The Surfing Historian.
What's happening? Thanks for having me, Jason. It's great to be here. I thought I would start with this story about how I kind of got into surfing and science. I was in grad school in Northern California, and I went with a buddy down to Santa Cruz, and we were gearing up to paddle out East Cliff side of town. And for those that are familiar with that area, at high tide, they are running low on beach. And we started to had a little chit and a little chat about what was going on with that situation. And it made me think a lot about the beach where I grew up, where at high tide, there is not a lot of beach left. And it made me wonder who was thinking about that issue, not just from a, how do we manage our cities and our coasts perspective, but from a, what does this mean for surfers perspective? And so it went from there.
Awesome, man. Dan, you know, again, thank you for being on. Super stoked to have you. And, I just want to, one of my first questions for you is, based on what you were saying about your experience surfing is, you call yourself, you're a self-proclaimed coastographer. And, can you just tell the viewer or the audience, the listeners, and even myself, what does that even mean? What do you do as a coastographer?
Yeah. So the first thing folks should know is if they like go home and, you know, tell their mom that they heard from a coastographer today and their mom doesn't know what they're talking about, that's totally fair because I made this word up. So the idea behind the coastography is that, so my background is in marine and ocean science and in coastal resource management. And what I came to appreciate doing that work is that coasts are quite unique systems, right? They are the interface between land and sea. There are oceanographic processes that affect coasts. There are terrestrial processes that affect coasts. There are things that humans do on coasts that we don't necessarily do other places in the ocean or on land. And so as I started to think about how I would position myself as a researcher, as a scholar, I decided that coasts need their own thing. And so we're recruiting right now. As far as I know, I'm the only coastographer. So if other people think that coasts are interesting, they're welcome to appropriate the label and run with it. But yeah, coastography is the study of coasts as unique systems.
Yeah, that's fascinating, man. It's, you know, thanks for explaining that. I really like this word you, I guess you've coined. So
it's actually my buddy, Andy. We're all sitting around having dinner, a bunch of students that I was in grad school with. And we were good. We thought maybe coastology, because ology, you know, ologies. But we ended up running, I decided to run with ography because of oceanography. And I believe there is actually debate in oceanography about whether they should become oceanology. But also because of geography, which is a little more interested in the human environmental interaction. And that's generally the focus of what I think about.
Yeah, no, it's a great term. I mean, it speaks for itself in a sense, but, you know, I'm glad that, for the listeners and maybe probably more so for myself, you kind of gave us a definition of it, but, you know, so as you said, you're a surfer, you're a coastographer. And in your article that I was reading, you know, you say surfing has increased in cultural, social, and economic importance through the last century and is now globally significant. And so sort of marrying your love for surfing with this, you know, your professional world, I guess, how do you see surfing and surf studies working together? And maybe the future of it as you begin to recruit more coastographers.
Yeah. Well, so I'm cognizant of the fact that I'm speaking with a historian. And so I want to be real careful about speaking out of my depth or my discipline here. But, you know, my research focus geographically is California. I totally get and that surfing and waves happen in other places of the world. I've gotten to enjoy many waves in many places, and that's great. But in terms of how I think about a coastline in particular, I really think about California. And when I think about California and the coast of California, and I think that when other people in other places anywhere in the world think about California, and they think about the coast of California, right? There's some iconic imagery that will pop into your mind. And it has to do with the coast itself and the waves that are there and the way that those waves are used by surfers. And so that element of California's coast is really significant culturally in this state and how we think about ourselves and how other people's think about California. And what I began to appreciate is that despite that, you know, cultural capital that surfing as this iconic activity on the coast of California has, there was not ever a super concerted effort to interrogate it academically and to understand how the ways that we affect and manage our coast might affect surfing. And so that was the genesis of my scholarly interest, was to try to understand what are the things that we do on coast as a society, as communities, and what does that mean for the waves and for the surfers?
Yeah, no, I mean, there's no doubt, you know, California's coast is insanely beautiful. And it's, of course, riddled with incredible surf breaks too. So it is a ripe field for, you know, academic inquiry. And so it does seem like you're in, you know, in the right place. But, you know, so one of the other things you do mention in the article is some of the innovations that have come about over the past century. And again, this is more world than your world than mine, but maybe a lot of it comes out of, say, World War II technology. And again, that's more of a question to you than a statement, but really, I guess I'm curious to know what sort of technologies have come out of the last century that have allowed you, as coastographer, as somebody who is.
I love that you keep saying coastography. That's like more times in one conversation than I've heard it in like the last couple of years. Well,
we want to, you know, again, we want it to catch. And so I might use it a few more times, but
thank you for humoring me.
Yeah, of course. But,
well, you know, so yeah, that, so to take that question and run with a little bit, the question about technology. Absolutely. So I think there's two ways to, or maybe two perspectives to come at it from. One is that, you know, technological innovation has really made surfing more accessible. And depending on your attitude and your vintage as a surfer towards those technologies, you might, you know, have differing opinions on them. But once upon a time, surfboards were incredibly heavy and not very maneuverable, and they were not connected to your body, and the water was cold. And so technological innovations in surfing have allowed people for example, right, the leash, the wetsuit, board construction that makes boards lighter and easier to carry, hold, maneuver, paddle, right? All of these things have made surfing more accessible to people who were not previously surfers. You know, look at the influx of new surfers that have happened just in the last 15 years with the real sort of advent of stand-up paddling, right? So there's a technological, and it's not like a new technology. People have been using paddles and boards for a real long time. But in terms of sort of mainstream surfing, right, like more people can now access this activity. I'm not going to call it a sport, but that's probably a separate podcast. Surfing is now accessible to more people. So that's sort of one angle, is how surfing has evolved to bring more people in. Just one more example, right? Like cheap pop-out boards, right? And you can go to Costco and get a $100 Wavestorm. Like suddenly there's the price barrier, right? The cost point comes way down, and it makes the activity accessible to people who couldn't previously have afforded it. And so on the kind of the other side of it, it's like, is our sort of society's technological ability to affect our coastlines and to think carefully about how we do that. So in a place like California, most of the major harbor construction, right, the real sort of significant modifications of our shoreline, jetties for harbors, you know, whether it was the Newport Bay, San Diego, right, major coastal construction projects. A lot of these began happening in the 20s and the 30s, some into the middle of the century. And that's not actually particularly nuanced technology. You basically pile up rocks. And I think piling up rocks is also probably pretty ancient human technology. But in the past, and I mean, you know, the prehistoric past, shorelines were incredibly dynamic systems, right? Sea level rises up and down over geologic time. Cultures that inhabit shorelines, they have to ebb and flow with what the shoreline is doing. And what we as a coastal society, and this is true in California, but in a lot of other parts of the United States and the world, what we've begun doing is really fixing that dynamic system in place through, you know, primitive technologies like piling up rocks, and increasingly sophisticated ways of, you know, building walls and sort of anchoring in place the development that we've put there, and coming up with more and more technologically sophisticated ways of protecting it. And there's, as this trend has continued, there's, as it's kind of continued alongside, a growing realization that those technologies can be problematic for beaches, they can be problematic for waves, they can be problematic for our ability as a user group to visit and use the beach and coastal resources. And so now there are new tools that are kind of entering the discourse. Managed retreat, natural coastline stabilization, right? Creating dunes. So other strategies besides walls and piles of rocks, but all of those have implications for how we use and how we enjoy a shoreline, a coastline.
Oh yeah. Thank you. You know, I do, you know, after, as you were talking, I wanted to sort of dig into your life a little bit as a coastographer. And by the way, I told you I'd use that one more time.
Yeah.
So you talk about all these new technologies and even some of the more, older technologies. What does your day-to-day research life look like, or you or your students or people in your field that are doing this work? Like, what does it entail?
That is an interesting question. Well, I think the first thing, you know, you mentioned, I teach at California State University, Channel Islands, and we're a teaching university. And so insofar as I get to pursue my research, I sometimes feel like I'm pursuing it on the side, unless I can come up with fun and creative ways to get my students involved. So my day-to-day is going to class and working with students. And I dig that. But stepping back and thinking about how I approach questions in coastography, you know, I consider this to be, insofar as it is a field, I consider it to be an applied field. And so I am interested in, as an academic, I'm interested in working with people and organizations who are doing work on the ground. So that could be, you know, a state agency that is trying to figure out, you know, shoreline management plans and, you know, equitable accessibility for people that are making like regulatory decisions, implementing policy. Right. So people say, oh, where do you get your research questions? It's like, well, I call up people who work at state agencies and I say, what do you need help with? Like, which data do you not have time to collect or analyze that you would like to see collected and analyzed so you can do your job better? And so to me, that's really important work. The other directions I'll go to the non-governmental community, the not-for-profit community, and I have lots of colleagues in those entities that are working on either at a grassroots level, top-down, different ways of engaging with coastal management through advocacy, through sort of grassroots organizing, as well as doing some really cool science and data collection of their own. And so I will partner with those organizations and say, how can I help with what you're working on? What questions do you have? Oh, that aligns with my interest here and here. Like, let's do this. So in that sense, I don't feel like I have to be like brilliantly creative to come up with great questions. I love coming up with questions, but I also really love finding out like what are the actual questions of the people that are doing the work that I think is important.
Yeah, no, I'm just curious, you know, because I know obviously what goes into my field in terms of methodology. And I do, you know, confessingly leverage that to be around surf spots to surf more for sure. And, but, you know, I guess.
Can I jump on that one?
Yeah, of course.
Yeah, this is just a fun side note. But, you know, in fields like, you know, particularly anthropology and some of the other sort of resource management field, the question is, you know, how are people using resources? And so they have a research approach, which is participant observation. So if you want to study how an artisanal society sort of conducts the business of fisheries management, right? How do they decide which fish to keep, which ones to throw back? Where do they fish? Wow, what do? You get on the boat and you go and fish with those guys. And so as someone who studies surfers and surfing, you know, I would tell my advisors, oh, I'm going to go do some participant observation. And they try to take that with a grain of salt.
I think that was where I was going with, you know, what is your day-to-day life?
Yeah. We can come back to that too.
Yeah. And so, you know, that I can speak for myself, we dress things up in all of this academic language, but I think, you know, many of us are really surfers. I wouldn't say surfers first, but certainly surfers at heart. And we found ways to be around the waves, but Again, and that's, you know, something you and I have talked about before, like that's at the heart of this podcast and everything we're doing is showing that you can be a surfer and you can be a serious academic and you can contribute in very much a positive way to making the world a better place, a cleaner place, a place that where people understand one another. And so I do think our field is important. And, you know, along those lines, I guess my question, you know, with you being up at Cal State Channel Islands, how do your students respond? Are your students like, hey, Dan, you know, man, this is a killer field. Like, I want to do what you're doing. What kind of response are you getting from the students?
Well, it's really interesting. So there's two broad domains to the work that I do, and studying surfing and surfing resource management is one of them. And there's another sort of overlapping domain. And for the radio audience, I'm like essentially trying to illustrate a Venn diagram with my hands. So one of those Venn diagram circles is surfing and surfing resource management. And the other one is really focused on public access to the shoreline and how do we manage that equitably? And, you know, a concept that I'm fascinated with, and this is a whole separate podcast, is something called the public trust doctrine, and which is a really ancient legal doctrine that defines who owns some of these resources that are kind of hard to be owned by one person. And so they are conceived as being owned by everybody. So we call them public trust resources, right? Things like oceans and air. And it turns out the shoreline is one of these public trust resources. And because it is a public trust resource, it is in the public trust. The government job is to manage it, hold it in trust for the public. And it belongs to all of us. And it is supposed to be managed in such a way to make it like accessible and usable by everyone. And I mean everyone. And so one of the things that I've noticed, and Jason, this is something that we were chatting about before, this idea that coastlines in California, but in other places too, gentrification, like different levels, right? Some places it's coastline that is still nominally affordable to the middle class is becoming slightly upper middle class. And then in places, certain places in California, it's, you know, upper middle class neighborhoods that are turning into, you know, the 1% of the 1% kind of neighborhoods, right? So the coastlines are changing. They are becoming more expensive because it's valuable property. And it's making it harder and harder for normal folk, and I put myself in that category, to get to and to use and enjoy the shoreline. We got to live farther. You got to drive farther. Parking is harder, right? So asking questions about that and how we can ensure that the coast is the most accessible to the most number of people is the other part of what I do. And so the community where I live and work and where my campus is, is not necessarily what you think of when you think of Southern California. We are technically Southern California, but this is an agricultural community. My campus is surrounded by you know, beautiful berry farms, and it's spectacularly beautiful for anyone that's had a chance to come through Cal State Channel Islands. If you hadn't, put it on your map. It's a short detour. Right. So there are these larger questions in the community that we serve, and they have much more to do with, you know, access and environmental justice, and less specifically with, say, surfing resources. So that is starting to change also. So I don't know if that like answers your question about like what do the students say? I guess
no, I think it's a hard question. I mean, maybe it's not a hard question, but you know, I have laughed with other guests in the past about, you know, we've called it like, you know, sort of the eye roll, you know, of Well, I do surf research and okay. So you want to, you know, essentially be in the water surfing all the time.
Which, little participant observation.
Yeah. A lot of participant observation. And, you know, so I do, that's why I'm always curious, you know, cause you're sort of within, you know, the sciences, in terms of what you guys do. And so, I don't know to, you know, what extent your students are surfers or not. And, but yeah, like you said, you know, you're up in, I believe in Camarillo, which
that's where our campus is. I live in Ventura.
Yeah. I mean, I remember going there in like the late 90s and it was just wide open fields. And so it is technically Southern California, but it doesn't have that same feel.
No, it has a real low key feel.
Yeah. And so I guess, you know, sort of drifting south a little bit into some, you know, kind of in and around where you grew up. So looking at the coastline and these larger homes coming in, how are you seeing that impact the coastline? And then maybe in a direct or indirect way, is that affecting the waves?
We'll see. One of the things, so stepping back a little bit, we talked about how shorelines are really dynamic systems, right? Sand erodes, it accretes. Bluffs erode, they don't accrete. And so it's this system that is in constant motion. And yet we find this system to be a great place to build houses, to build highways, to build railroad tracks, to build other public infrastructure, parks, and that sort of thing. And as the shoreline changes, it becomes necessary to protect all of those structures. And California as a state, North Carolina, other states have, we were talking about North Carolina before, have varying levels of protection against fixing a shoreline in place with a human-made structure. When that happens, it essentially halts the shoreline's ability to naturally adapt to changing conditions. And that can have really negative consequences for the beach in front of a seawall and potentially for the waves that, you know, break at that beach. But, you know, one of the reasons why I like to think of coastography and, you know, coasts as these unique systems, right? It's not just what we do on the shoreline, right? If you are a coastal community and we're worried about, you know, our erosion and our beaches getting smaller, one of the things that these communities will quite often do is they will do beach nourishment, which means piping through it from a dredge or else trucking sand to their beaches from other places. And it is not cheap to do this, but if you're a local community and you rely on a lot of beach related tourism and recreation, then having a big sandy beach is worth paying for. So after you get around the hurdles of determining where that sand will come from and you put it down on your beach, maybe it's going to wash away again, maybe it's not. The question that these communities often don't ask is, you know, why is the sand not naturally replenishing in the first place, right? And so we have to look up coast, right? Is there a jetty or a break wall or a groin field or something that might affect the flow of set of sand along a coast? But you also have to look into the watershed, right? Many of our watersheds in Southern California do not look like natural rivers and watersheds, right? I mean, a lot of great Hollywood movies have been filmed in the LA River, which it doesn't look, I mean, you can't do a car chase in a river. You would do like a boat scene, right? But they do car chases in the LA River, right? That is no longer a natural system. And the fact that it's been turned into a giant concrete channel has implications for how sand, sediment, moves through a watershed down a river to a shoreline where it might result in a beach, or if you pave it and channelize it, where it might never arrive. So I can't even remember what your question was. That was like a rambly thing. Now I'm thinking about Terminator and other stuff, but
is that where that scene was filmed? I guess I didn't think about that, but yeah, little movie trivia during this episode. I appreciate that. I guess I was
someone I'm sure you'll probably get angry letters. I am not a movie history buff, so but I'm pretty sure that's the LA River.
We're going to go with it for this podcast. And
Terminator 2.
Yeah. No, yeah. So you're referencing, and we're really digressing right now, but you're referring to the scene where the tractor trailer is coming over, and I think it's Guns N' Roses, You Could Be Mine is playing.
Oh my God.
So, well, you said, that's a great scene, by the way. I did not, we're going to just kind of imagine it being in the LA River, even if it's not. So, but I guess, kind of pushing a little more on that, I guess I was thinking of, I'm wondering if you could give some examples before, of course, we move over and talk a little bit about the Outer Banks of North Carolina, which is something you and I have talked about before. But down where you are from, the San Diego area, are there any examples of where these buildings essentially on these cliffs are having major negative consequences, or putting the homeowners in danger because of this desire to be right there on the edge, so to speak? And is there, and how is that being mitigated, or is it not?
So there's definitely some legal nuance to this question about which houses, which homes, which properties are able to protect their private property by building a seawall at the expense of the public, and which properties don't. And the regulatory body in California that is tasked with making those decisions is the California Coastal Commission. They implement a state law called the California Coastal Act. And there is a little bit of conflict in the act itself, how the certain provisions are written. So setting that aside, there are plenty of places in Southern California where beaches are not as wide as they would be because armoring to protect homes on bluffs or sort of upper parts of beaches are, encroaching on the public trust beach. They are certainly aesthetically displeasing, but there's also, I'm going to call them amazing stories, but not like good amazing, but stories, from, for example, Malibu, where homeowners hire private security guards to keep the beach going public off of what they have determined to be the private part of the beach. And so this question of where does the line get drawn is again an interesting and nuanced question. But so to try to answer your question in a sentence, there's a lot of conflict about who gets to protect their private property and how, and what effects that has on the rest of us. And maybe you'll want to clip this out of the audio because this is like a totally random anecdote. But one of my favorite books is Catch 22. And it's about Yossarian, who's a bombardier in the B-22 in the European theater during World War II, and Yossarian does not like to go up in the bomber and go drop bombs because all of the enemy planes and anti-aircraft fire are shooting at the planes. But he doesn't see it that way. He says, "They're shooting at me. I don't want to do this anymore." And they're like, "No, Yossarian, like they're shooting at everybody, right? It's a collective. They're shooting at you." And it is to my mind probably a stretch, but it's an analogy to what's happening on the coast, where private individuals get to protect their private property at the expense of the public. And so when I go down there, I'm like, that's me. They're like, that's my beach. They're taking away my beach, right? To protect that, but they're taking away everybody's beach. And so it introduces a really interesting question about, as the shoreline moves, right? And sea level is rising, the shoreline is going to move. Does the public trust, right? That part of the coast and ocean that belongs to everybody, does that get to move also, or do private individuals get to have the right to say, no, the public land stops here, the private land starts here, and that is going to be baked in perpetuity? And so this is an interesting question that California is grappling with right now. And other places, if they haven't solved the problem already, are going to be grappling with it as well.
Yeah, no, and I think that it, you know, you raise some very interesting, you know, questions as to the nuances of it, and you know, the individual, the private owner's, you know, sort of access to private property versus the public's access to the beach. And you know, again, California, I think, is really provides a really good case study in that. As you said, you know, this is something that Californians are certainly grappling with. Another place, and I just kind of, I'm segueing over to the East Coast. Another place that's really grappling with this, you know, shifting sands, quite literally and
literally,
are the Outer Banks of North Carolina. And I know that's a place you're familiar with. And so, but I'm going to pull a quote from your article, and I just, you know, I just want to get your thoughts on just all of that that's taking place around the Outer Banks. Is that you say coastal sediment is also subject to a variety of transport processes. Aeolian transport is important in dune systems above the high water mark, but within littoral cells. Key transport mechanisms include offshore, onshore, and longshore current patterns. And so hopefully I pronounced some of those words right, but what does that mean? And sort of for myself, who is not in, you know, I don't work in your world, and maybe for some of the listeners unfamiliar, can you explain how that relates to, say, a place like the Outer Banks?
Sure. I'll also commend to you the work of some colleagues who are coastal geomorphologists whose job it is to study the morph, the shape of the geo, the land, and they specifically working on coastlines. They're interested in exactly this question of how and why sand moves around, and how and why our actions on coastlines muck it up. I will, in particular, since you're asking about North Carolina, I will suggest that you pull on the show a guy named Rob Young, who's a super fun, dynamic guy, and he. I'm going to botch the name of it. It's this Institute for the Study of Managed Shorelines might be the name of it, but he's in North Carolina. So he's your guy on Outer Banks. I'm just an occasional Outer Banks tourist. But what I do know is that the Outer Banks are essentially a very large barrier island system. And barrier islands are essentially sand dunes that broke the surface and stayed there. But they never stay in one place for long. And so once you've put a house on a barrier island and you've invested in that house or that road or that store, right, now you're incentivized to keep it where it is and to protect it, because it's hard to move roads. It's hard to move houses. And so what is the situation on the Outer Banks is that as a barrier island system, they are naturally incredibly dynamic. They migrate out to sea, they migrate inland, and it just depends how waves and currents sort of on a daily basis and other large episodic events like hurricanes, right, how those forces are moving sand around. And if we weren't building houses and roads and stores and all that, then it wouldn't be such an issue. The Outer Banks would shift and change and evolve. And that's what was happening for, you know, the last few dozen millennia. But now that we've put structural roots down, we as humans are in conflict with that natural ebb and flow. And so that's why right now we see sort of erosional forces on the eastern side of the Outer Banks, threatening and washing away a lot of houses that are on increasingly tall pilings and then eventually falling in the ocean. It was like, it's really sad that was someone's house, but it also was maybe not the best place to build in the first place.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's, again, I growing up sort of in and around that area, surfing the Outer Banks, you know, spending a lot of time there surfing, staying there. And, you know, even recently, just in talking to my dad, who we just sold a little cottage all the way down at the end towards Frisco, just talking about how the sand is shifting and, you know, places used to be able to drive on the beach or, you know, whatnot, how that is changing. And if I'm not mistaken, my uncle, I think, was on the Coastal Commission. And this is, you know, as you know, being over in California, as more and more people began investing and building, say, in the Outer Banks, it has become a growing issue. There's no doubt about it. And I think I remember, I feel like it was my dad that shared this with me, but I found it fascinating, these models of, you know, sort of time lapse, if you will, of how the Outer Banks was moving. And you're right, like we as humans are trying to fight nature, you know, as opposed to, you know, maybe
going with the flow.
Yeah. Exactly. As opposed to, as we like to do in the water, you know, dance with nature, if you will. And so that was my segue, by the way, because I want to talk
about.
No, that
was good. That was very slick.
Yeah, I want to talk about surfing and waves, actually. So how does all of this, you know, how do waves work with respect to some of these shorelines? Like, why are all of these waves so different? Like, what makes them different?
Oh, yeah, that's a great question. So, oceanographically, there are different kind of waves, different kinds of waves. We'll just focus on the ones that like normal surfers are interested in, right? Which is not tsunamis, not there's seiches and there's tidal waves. There's you know, river bores. We're going to set all that aside. And we're just talking about normal surface gravity waves, which are waves that are ginned up by some wind somewhere in the ocean. They travel through the water as essentially pulses of energy that are moving water molecules. And they travel across the ocean and they arrive on shorelines. And so the same storm could generate the same set of waves. They're going to propagate out from that storm. And depending what kind of coastline they arrive at, that's where the rubber meets the road. That's a terrible turn of phrase in this instance. I'm sure you will come up with like a really good sort of ocean-y analogy later, but how any individual surf break functions is a function of the coast that it's on, the geologic endowments of that coast, right? Is it a sandy beach? Is it a bouldery beach? Is it, is it all like hard fixed rocky reef? There's also, you know, biological considerations, right? Is it a living shoreline, right? Is it a coral reef? Is it, you know, mangroves or what have you? The direction of the coast, like the orientation of the coast relative to the origin of a swell. If the substrate, if the seafloor in a given place is not fixed, right? If it's sand or sediment or cobble, the extent to which it is free to move around, how it is transported from where to where, sources of sand, sinks of sand. So all of these factors play into what kind of waves you're going to get and how they're going to break. And, you know, whether you're getting a surf spot at all, as opposed to, not a surf spot, just like I just normal coast. I tend to drive past those parts, but.
Yeah. And thank you for, explaining that. And again, I think a lot of surfers understand that, but for all of our listeners who may not be surfers or may not understand how waves work and its relationship to the bottom of the ocean and the contours, thank you for explaining that. And
we left out all the physical oceanographers, including the ones like my brother and my sister-in-law, they're all going to roll their eyes because we left out an awful lot of really important detail.
You gave the cliff notes of.
Yeah. And we'd need like the whiteboard to really do it right. And that just doesn't work with the radio audience.
Yeah, true. Good point. But, as I still think it was helpful to sort of, bring together your research and why waves are so different along the coast or around the world. As you're talking, I'm still thinking of, say, the Outer Banks and the shifting, shifting sandbars, essentially. All of the listeners that surf, probably the surf beach breaks are, thinking like, we have to chase new sandbars all the time because of that, what's taking place underneath the ocean. And, the Outer Banks is a, really good case in point, because I just, as growing up, it'd be like, oh, well, man, at this mile marker, there's a sandbar this summer, surf isn't great, necessarily, but like in the fall, like, man, this new break is working now. And so, yeah, thanks. Yes, obviously it's very much nuanced, but I do appreciate you, sort of offering insight into, how it all works, kind of summing up how it all works. So, yeah, I think it makes a lot of sense.
And so I'll just jump on that. And I'll tie it back to a question you asked before, which is, how it is that I go about studying waves as resources. And like you said, like the Outer Banks is a really different situation than in California. California, really different situation than Hawaii. And so one of my strategies is to go to the surfers who know those places, right? I think it is important to recognize that, surfers are not just surfers, right? And Ricky Griggs' sort of turn of phrase is some surfers are magical oceanographers, because you have to be, right? You don't get to go out and know where to be and how to position yourself, or even like where to look, where to go look for waves, without paying attention to an awful lot that's going on in the ocean and in sort of the broader weather. Like, you have to pay attention to these things to be a surfer. If you just humor me, there's a great quote from William Bill Finnegan, who wrote Barbarian Days. That'd be another really cool podcast. I pulled it up so I could just in advance, because I knew that we'd get here. And I just want to read it because it's so great. But he says, the close, painstaking study of a tiny patch of coast, every eddy and angle, even down to individual rocks, and in every combination of tide and wind and swell, a longitudinal study through season after season, is the basic occupation of surfers at their local break. And so I love that. I love that he got a Pulitzer for that book. I totally agree with that. And so I one of the things I sort of see my job, or my, I see an opportunity as a scholar to figure out ways to collect that knowledge, right? That wave knowledge, and use it to help us understand and better manage our coasts and shorelines to protect those resources that surfers are out there studying every day.
No, right on. As you're talking, and even given that quote, I think about, again, I know I keep going back to the Outer Banks, but this is back in the 90s, before we had Surfline and Magic Seaweed, which I guess now is one and the same. But watching Weather on the Eights, I think it was Weather on the Eights on the weather, literally the Weather Channel, and looking at wind direction and really an amateur oceanographer or amateur meteorologist. And by the way, I originally went to, when I transferred to North Carolina State, I put that I wanted to be a meteorologist, and I quickly found out I don't have the math skills. So I'm an amateur meteorologist and an amateur oceanographer at best. But yeah, I think you're spot on. We obsess over these little tiny pieces of coastline and everything that's happening around us, the weather, the contours of the ocean, all of that impacts that wave that, you know, we call our quote unquote local break. I want to, you know, kind of along those lines, because, you know, earlier you mentioned, you know, we sort of briefly talked about climate change. How does climate change impact those surf breaks that, you know, we call our home break or our local break? Like, what does climate change have to do with that? How does it impact it or change it or make it better or worse?
Oh God, I'm going to give you the worst answer, non-answer ever. But it depends, right? So we just a minute ago, we were talking about all the different kinds of surf spots that surf breaks that we have at present. They are all going to be affected in different ways by the different aspects of our climate that are changing. So, for example, warming trends in ocean basins are going to change the location and intensity of storms. And so if storms are originating in different places, they're going to arrive on coastlines in different angles. And that might have implications for a wave that has a very narrow swell corridor, or maybe it won't if that particular surf break can take a swell from any angle. You know, we as surfers, we are all familiar with the idea that like the level of the ocean goes up and down every day, right? That's the tide. That's a natural thing. And sea level rise driven by climate change, driven by global warming, is going to make our high tides higher, and it's going to make our low tides higher. And that too will have implications for how waves are going to break. So if your local break seems to break well on all tides, that maybe bodes well. If it only breaks, like if that little rocky shelf only picks up swell when the tide is really low, right, now you're kind of in a pickle, because as sea level rises, like that low tide water level is going to cease to occur. And you start to look at places like in the tropical latitudes where a lot of the surf breaks happen over coral reefs, right? Now you are layering sort of changes in ocean basin with changes in sea level, with changes in temperature, and how all of that will affect sort of the living coral organism. And so that adds a whole other layer of complexity and challenge, both to, you know, making like prognosticating how things are going to change, but also to just, you know, the different kinds of science that are implicated in like answering that question, like, oh, like, well, how healthy is that reef? How likely is it to be able to, you know, maintain at its current location and depth as water warms and acidifies and sea level rises?
And yeah, that was, you know, yeah, I like, it depends. And it really does. And I think you did a good job articulating the nuances of, you know, a broad nuance of the varying ways waves can be impacted by sea level rise. And so, you know, I just want to thank you for sharing your knowledge with our listeners, with myself as well. And with that, I want to go ahead and give you the last word.
Yeah. So, shoots. Okay. A couple things. Can I, like, it's going to be more than, it's gonna be like a couple words. Okay. How are we doing on time? So the first thing is that, like, recognizing all of that nuance, right? Like the, it depends, that like every surfer who knows and loves their local break, they are perfectly positioned to become the person who is going to be the expert on how climate change and coastal management decisions and how all of that is going to affect their wave. Like, there is no one better. And so thinking about how to capture that information, thinking about how to record it and how to, you know, elevate in the discourse about adapting to climate change, how to like elevate the role of local surfers as not just like, oh, hey, dude, surfer, but like as actual like resource experts of their place, right? I think that's a really important thing that we all could collectively get behind to improve our ability to understand and manage our waves into the future. And then maybe the last thing, this is something that I worry about a lot, but there's an idea called shifting baselines, and it comes out of fisheries. But the idea is that sort of what we compare change to in a system is our own early experiences with it. And so when I think about how the coast in San Diego is today, I'm comparing it to how it was when I was a little kid growing up in San Diego. But that's different to how it was for my dad, and it's different to how it was for my granddad. And so the idea is that as each generation passes, we lose access to this knowledge about how the coast was, about how the waves were. And it's one thing to look at old pictures, but it's another thing to talk to old surfers and have them tell you how it was to paddle out at a place that's different now or even gone altogether. And so not just collecting the knowledge of sort of today's surfer at their local break, but also trying to capture the knowledge of kind of our elders who have been studying these tiny patches of coast for decades and decades and decades, and collecting that collective wisdom, that will help us to understand and protect these places that we love.
If you enjoyed my conversation with Dan about coastal resource management, I'd like to invite you to check out my next episode, where I'll be joined by Assistant Director for International Programs at the University of South Florida Health International, Jesse Casanova. Jesse and I will be talking about the health risk associated with international surf travel. And for the record, Jesse wanted me to add the caveat that the point of our episode is not to scare people or dissuade surfers from traveling around the world, but rather to inform them on how to effectively prepare for their next trip. As someone who spends a lot of time traveling to surf, I'm personally looking forward to our interview. Jesse has a wealth of knowledge in this area, so if you're getting amped up for an upcoming surf trip or you're planning one, this will no doubt be an episode you won't want to miss. We also want to take a moment to thank Santa Barbara Surf Company again for sponsoring this episode. Don't forget to check them out at sbsurfco.com. And while you're there, use promo code STAYSTOKED for a discount on your purchase. Thanks for joining us for another episode of The Surfing Historian. If you're stoked on these conversations, be sure to share, like, and subscribe to never miss an episode. And don't forget to check out our killer merch at surfinghistorian.com. Proceeds go to help keep this amazing podcast going strong. Until next time, stay stoked.